Hello, I'm Eugene Kim, and I welcome you to On Death, the podcast where we talk about death through the four prompts. I am, before I die, I want, when I die, I want, and after I die, I want. This week, we're digging back into the final Dirty Dozen podcast. This is Samson Liu. I think you'll like it a lot. It's great. Sorry for being a little bit late. Thanksgiving has been a little weird. This is the first time I've actually posted a podcast late in the, 9 months that we've done this. So hopefully it's not the start of a thing. And hopefully your Thanksgiving was pretty righteous. Or, you know, whatever the most recent day of celebration and thanks that you participate in happens, you know, if you listen to this in the future, not right now. So hope you enjoy this conversation with Samson Liu. Good evening. I'm Eugene Kim, and I welcome you to On Death, the podcast where we talk about death through four prompts. I am, before I die, I want, when I die, I want, and after I die, I want. This week, I interviewed Samson Liu. He's an amazing, he's a very interesting fellow, plays the violin and piano like a boss. We talk a whole lot about what it means to be 26 years old, to be Chinese American, racial identity, just all sorts of. We have a very wide ranging conversation. But before we get too deep into that, I want to talk a little bit about my long form Sundays post. I do a long form reflection about my experiences in medical school. And this past week, I rambled a whole lot about Kung Fu Panda, the Kung Fu Panda trilogy, and medical education. I've been watching the Kung Fu Panda trilogy as I study in the background, sort of like as good, consistent background white noise while I listen to lectures on a second screen, and it's delightful because A, I love the Kung Fu Panda series, and B, because it has been seeping into my brain in a very interesting way. And the lessons on how do you teach others, how do you learn, have really, I've been able to sort of stew on it in various ways. And it's a very, very well-written trilogy. And I'm very excited that there's another trilogy coming out for Kung Fu Panda, but that's irrelevant right now. I also relate this to a medical education and the problem with teaching knowledge versus teaching wisdom or gaining wisdom. So check it out at Mobility and Mindfulness Work of the Day or MNMWOD.com, MNMWOD. That's also you can check it out on Facebook and YouTube, all sorts of things. So back to Samson. Samson is a technically, he's somewhere between a third and fourth year medical student. He took time off. He took a break between, he's done his third year, and he's back in Tampa completing a master's in public health degree. So it's really interesting stuff. I think his public health slant shows very well in his responses. He's a very interesting cat. I've saw him play music, both violin and the piano, at a recent scholars dinner for scholarship dinner for USF medical school and DPT, all the health related fields. It was a great evening, and watching him play was one of the highlights because he is so engaged in the music, and he channels something, and it's beautiful to watch. And we're also kind of doppelgangers. We're both long-haired Asian fellows with same height. We wear glasses. It's very, very funny. I get confused for him a lot on campus, but I'm growing my facial hair out, so hopefully that'll help differentiate us because he's clean-shaven. He's also the first person to run here to the interview and run away from, but leave the interview, not via car. So that was also kind of neat. He settled into the interview. He was still a little sweaty, but it was good. It was a great conversation. Like I said earlier, we talk about things like racial identity, what it's like to, how he was taught the violin versus how he learned the piano. He was, you know, intrinsic, extrinsic motivation, all sorts of things. It's a very lovely conversation, and I think you'll enjoy it a whole lot. We cover a lot of ground, and we just banter a lot. So enjoy this hour-long discussion with Samson Liu on death. It is April 12th, 2016. I'm sitting here in my apartment in Tampa with Samson Liu, and we'll be talking on death with using four prompts. Samson, do you know what the four prompts are, or to the best of your recollection?
Yeah. Before I die, after I die, something else along those lines.
Yeah. We got the gist of it. So the first prompt is I am. And I am dot dot dot. How do you finish that prompt?
All right. I am a 26-year-old male, Chinese American, and I am interested in music and medicine. Those are my two primary passions, and they sort of mixed together in college.
How so?
So, I started college as a violin performance major, and then in my first year of undergrad, I played violin for patients at the hospital as part of a volunteering activity that was part of my scholarship for violin. And through that, I got to understand medicine a bit more and got a lot of patient interaction, which was nice because I spent time one-on-one with patients playing for them. So,
at that point, had you had any interest in medicine?
I think my parents definitely mentioned to me that I should do medicine, but I think music was still my main passion at that time. But music is still a heavy interest of mine. I love playing with friends that I've made here, and it's just being able to reach out to people through music, I think, is very important to me and meaningful. When you play stuff that people recognize or have had a song or something has had a profound impact in their life, say like it's their wedding song or it's the song that they listened to as a child growing up, making those sort of connections is meaningful. And I think medicine to me is also about connecting with people and being able to understand what they're going through, and then you have the knowledge and tools to be able to alleviate any suffering that they're going through.
Like almost like you get to, it's like spiritual music, or spiritual medicine almost, like music is. You get to tap into something that you can't really access through pharmaceuticals, through a physical exam. It's like that music can awaken something and allow a little bit of healing on a more ineffable, ethereal level.
In a way, yeah. There's definitely been examples of that. When I was playing for people throughout the years, I think one that stands out to me very clearly is when a patient had undergone brain surgery, I think 2 weeks prior to when I arrived, and it was him and his wife inside the room. I told him I was a volunteer violinist, and she was like, I don't know if he'll hear you because he's been kind of out of it since then, since 2 weeks ago. So I was like, okay, I'll just play something, and I played, I think, Meditation from Thais or something slow. And then afterwards, he like beckoned to his wife and whispered to her, tell him thank you. And she was like, wow, that's the first time he's spoken since his surgery. So it was a very emotional time for all of us. So I think music has a way of reaching people that may be hard to reach otherwise.
Actually, this is a semi-related but a little funny side story. I do float tank therapy or flotations. And so you're just laying there in water, and it's totally enclosed and it's dark. And yesterday I was floating, I was doing a 2-hour float, and it was actually the first time I'd ever fallen asleep, and it was also the first time I'd ever dreamed while I was in there. So it was a very unique, and I've been floating for about a year now, about 3 times a week for the last couple months. So I'm a very experienced floater,
And usually I go in there and I'm pretty conscious the whole time. And like when people knock on the tank to say like, oh, it's time to go, I'm like pretty, I can knock back almost immediately because I'm pretty conscious the entire time. And yesterday I floated and I fell like into a deep sleep and I was dreaming. And I remember it was a very boring dream that I just got out of the tank and I was just like, oh, I'm still here. But one of my friends works at the float place, Grant Italiano. He actually was interviewed earlier for this podcast. Mm-hmm. And we have this funny thing where he'll play the singing bowl, the Tibetan singing bowl, these little fellas.
Okay.
If you've never heard it, I'll play it for you later. But it's a very distinct sound, and he plays that to like rouse me out because, you know, when I'm conscious, I can hear it, and it's like the coolest sound because my ears are underwater. I can feel it almost on like I feel it like it's coming from the tank rather than from outside of the tank. Mm-hmm. And he was telling me that when he was playing it, he was noticing that I was snoring, and he was like, "Oh, that's weird. He's never asleep when he's floating." So he was like knocking, and I wasn't really moving or anything. And he started playing the singing bowl to try to wake me up, and he was just like laughing because every time he started playing the singing bowl, I would start snoring louder, and it was doing something to me, and it was just so interesting that it can tap into something much much deeper, and like almost on even when you're not fully conscious, it can do things to you. Mm-hmm. Music can just those simple little vibrations.
Yeah, how do you breathe in the floating tank?
Carefully.
You're on your back?
On your back. You're not face down.
And you, wait, it's just you?
Just me.
There's nothing else helping to keep you up?
Oh, it's hypersalinated water. So it's like the Dead Sea, you float on top. Okay. Yeah, it's not, not floaties. Okay, so let's cycle back a little bit. You mentioned that you're a 26-year-old Chinese-American.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean to be a 26-year-old to you? And B, what does it mean to be Chinese-American?
26 years old means it's time to start growing up. It's that time when your parents keep on asking you when you're gonna get a girlfriend and settle down.
Mm-hmm.
It's also that time when you, I guess for me at least, it's almost where I'm out of school, where I'm gonna earn money consistently for the first time, and it'll be exciting. I think that part will be exciting. But it's still a time of exploration where if you have dreams and you have endeavors, you still pursue them. And I think that's true for me, for both the medical side and the music side. I'm still seeking out opportunities to improve constantly.
Mm. It's a very interesting time in our lives where I'm 26 as well. And it's at a point where, you know, when you're young, all the doors are open. All the doors. You just have to pick a direction to run down. And, you know, once you hit your 20s, mid-20s, the doors are still very open, but you're far along enough a path that you can really kind of see down it and understand what's happening. But you're not at a point where doors are starting to close more rapidly than they're opening. And mm-hmm. it's a very interesting tipping point because once we enter the 30s, then like doors are closing and you have to sort of like almost like commit to a step or choose, do I come off of the path that I'm already on? And it is a very interesting point in our lives.
Yep, for sure.
But what about the Chinese American part?
I think there's a unique identity associated with being Chinese American. A few days ago, I won Mr. Asia at USF, and we had similar questions asked.
Congratulations.
For us. Thank you. I think, you know, growing up in a dual culture, essentially, where at home, a lot of the ways of life are different than when you go outside and a lot of your peers don't live the same way, like don't eat the same things, don't speak the same language, don't have the same kind of history. It's been nice though to be able to see the good sides and the beneficial sides personally in both cultures growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to just keep those with me as I live through life. I think it's helped me a lot. Because there's a lot of people do have dual cultures, but being Chinese American, where your parents came to the U.S. Like when you were really young, and then you moved here as well later on. I think that sort of situation is unique. Your parents are the immigrants. I guess you are too, technically, but you are, I think, still more in touch than some of your other Chinese American friends who maybe were born here with your Chinese culture. And it can be hard to find people who are similar or like relate in a similar level. Mm-hmm. By that I mean like I speak Chinese more or less fluently, and a lot of Chinese Americans who were born here don't speak as fluently, so it's more like we just speak English to each other. But then if I try to speak to a Chinese person who is absolutely fluent in Chinese, there are things that I will still miss. Mm-hmm. So it's like I'm in this little niche where the language can be a barrier. The culture is also a little bit of a barrier. I'm not fully either side. So
it's very interesting because like to your point about how it's like there are almost gradations, and there's a very strong spectrum even amongst like first generation immigrants or like children of first generation immigrants. Like when I earlier asked you like where are you from originally, I was referring to like where in the States did you grow up, and I thought it was really interesting that you said China, because if you were to ask me, I would say New Hampshire, because I mean I was born in New Hampshire, but my Korean identity is very abstract. It's very, very abstract. And my parents have westernized a lot. And it's been very interesting because in retrospect, I'll think about it. And like, as I grow up, they're westernizing more. So it's a very fluid relationship. And I have to remember that the person that was the Eugene that was growing up as a 5-year-old boy had parents that were more Korean than they are now. And it's it's so fluid. And even in for you, especially like at having, and like my sister learned Korean when she was in college, and my parents will still pick on her, like, you sound like a baby. And it's like, what do you expect? You know, it's like, we didn't speak, like in our household, we didn't speak growing up.
Gotcha.
My parents really focused on trying to teach us English and being very, very fluent in it. And I think it shows in the way that I talk and the way that I think, but it's also, it creates a gulf between me and Korea, me and my motherland. And I am a little jealous of you and your ability to speak it and to feel that connection. But also at the same time, you're close, but still not there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, true. I think it's mostly little things that I miss when I go back to China, when my cousins are speaking to me or my aunts, and there's just phrases that I don't know or words that I've never heard of. And I just have to ask them, what does that mean? There are also some cultural nuances that I have not grown up with here that are missed.
How often do you go back?
On average, once every 4 years, but there was a 7-year gap in the past 8 years. I went last year, and then 7 years before that.
And how have the, if it's, I mean, every 4 years, that's a very regular and very distinct developmental points. And how has your relationship to China changed throughout those years and throughout those visits?
It's a good question. I don't know that I've thought that much about it. My relationship with China, I think that I've become more, I don't know if I've become more comfortable being in China or if I just didn't think about it before. I think I'm impressed with China and its growth. I think it has grown a lot since, like, I remember being there when I was 10, I think, and then this last time that I was there, there's just been a huge amount of development. Economy has gone up a lot, and like a lot of different buildings have gone up in my hometown. Although like real estate is really just really expensive right now, and it definitely marginalizes some people in the society, but I think overall it's been improving a lot. I don't know what else to say about my relationship with China. I don't have that strong a relationship, I guess. Mm-hmm. I just go back to visit family, mm-hmm. pretty much. And I've gone to tour around China, and that's been nice. But it's mostly just staying with family.
Mm. Do you have, like, a lot of aunts, a lot of grandparents, a lot of, like, cousins?
So my two grandmothers are still alive. My grandfathers are not. And then I have four cousins, and then a handful of aunts and uncles. Not too many, though.
Mm. And when you visit, who are you visiting primarily? Like, is it the grandmothers? Is it the aunts and uncles? Is it the cousins? Like, which generation?
It's usually everybody all at once, because they live really close to one another, and they eat out every night, like, huge amounts of food. If you imagine a circular table that can sit like 15 people, and then it's just piled with like seafood and vegetables, it's great. But I do have an uncle and aunt who live in Beijing. That's not my hometown, so I don't go visit them as much. Sometimes they come when we come back. But they also go to America. They're the other people in my family who have lived in America before.
Mm-hmm.
So I get to see them kind of less consistently than my relatives who are in Qingdao, which is where I was born.
Mm. Yeah, and the reason why I ask is because it's, for me, I can see my relationship with Korea being almost entirely untethered when my grandparents, I have one grandmother left in Korea, and my aunts and uncles die. When they, mm-hmm. when they're gone, I almost have, I have cousins there, but I don't know them. And mm-hmm. I met them very briefly, only once. I've only been to Korea once, but it's like a, I can't, like, once they're gone, I'm like, it's like, Korea is this country that I can blend in entirely. Like, I look like everyone else,
mm-hmm.
but I don't speak the language, and I don't have that, like, this is my father's brother, or this is my mother's brother, you know? And it's,
mm-hmm.
like, a very interesting, like, but for you, I think it's beautiful that it's not just that one generation that you're connected to. It's like there's a strong anchor for you there, and that will remain after those grandmothers pass or the aunts and uncles pass.
True. When did you go back to Korea?
I went during my sophomore year of college.
Mm.
So, goodness, that's like 6 years ago. And it was interesting, because I had to be passed along between cousins or like people that spoke English that could like act as a translator. So there was only so much that I could do, but there was also a couple points where I would be alone. And it was just so interesting to just realize, like, I'm standing here, and for the first time in my life, I blend in, you know? And it was such a very warm but also alienating feeling, because, yes, I blend in, but I don't belong here. Like, I can't communicate. I don't understand the customs entirely. And I spent 3 days doing a temple stay at a Buddhist temple. And that was really beautiful, because all the monks had vows of silence. So there was nothing beyond physical body language that separated me from them. And it was very interesting to see, like, just how welcoming they were. And I also had buzz cut hair, so I looked like a monk. Like, it was very, very funny. And when I wore their garb, it was just like, Eugene's a monk now. It's crazy. And to just blend in like that was one of the highlights for me for my visit, was just like, with a lot of layers removed, just being able to, like, not even just be amongst the monks, but also be on the land and just sit and just enjoy the temple. It was very, very peaceful.
Wow.
Mm.
I can't imagine how unique that would be, that experience.
Mm. And also, imagine for you, it's very weird to, because in the same way my fluid relationship with my parents, it's a very fluid relationship with China, because it's not like it's static. It's not like the same China your parents came from.
Mm-hmm.
It is a very different China, and it's changing every 5 years.
Yep.
Mm. So you are a 26-year-old Chinese American. You have an interest in medicine and music.
Mm-hmm.
What else are you?
What else am I? I don't know. Semi-athlete. Play badminton, table tennis, basketball. Primarily badminton and table tennis. Mm. I don't know what else I am.
It's a tough question, right?
Yeah.
It's like lay it down. Like, what are you? Oh, are you ready to start talking about death then?
Let's do it.
All right. How do you finish the prompt, before I die, I want?
Before I die, I want to... I want to do good in the world. I want to leave something that will last beyond my time here on Earth. And I'd like to have a family and be able to raise children in a safe environment. And I think a lot of it is leaving behind something good, something that will benefit other people. 'Cause I've had a lot of people help me out through the years, and I know people will have been continuing to help me out now, and that's primarily the I guess overarching goal that I have for me. I'm not that big into material goods. I think I would like to have a house by the beach. That's something that I would like. But otherwise, a lot of people have it worse than me, and I have it pretty darn good. So it's just kind of filling in those gaps or supporting change that will make more people have a better quality of life, essentially. Like, less racism, less... income inequality, more functional democracy kind of thing.
Mm. So let's tease it out a little bit. Mm. You want to leave a legacy behind of some sort,
yeah.
And you also want to do good. Do you see those as the same thing or different things?
I think they can be the same thing. I think I've been inspired by a lot of donors for education,
mm-hmm.
Scholarships for underprivileged people, or merit scholarships.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if I do have enough money in the future, that's a very good way to give back, to be able to support the next generation of scholars and people who are able to support society and... beneficial way and be able to follow their passions, decrease inequalities in a sense.
Mm. And I'm very struck by that's what you go to first, the scholarships and making sure that like underprivileged individuals are still able to get an education and do good for their communities. But I'm also interested in the fact that it's not musically related at all, or you know what I mean? It's not necessarily medically related at all.
Yeah, I think it's important for people to follow their own passions. And it's, for me, I would, I might end up donating to like medical school or something music related, but I'll go with the way I want to raise my kids is to, like, if they have a passion, if they're interested in something, I would surround them with more resources in that area so that they can explore and find if that really is what they like to do. And I feel like if you have that sense of your own energy coming and pursuing something, you will be a lot more successful at it than if somebody told you to do something.
Mm.
And so, like, scholarship-wise, I'd like to find that as well, if to be able to support people who are self-driven and have been able to find their passions and stick with it and persevere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I remember watching you. You played at the Scholars Donors like dinner, and it was a great evening. And watching you play your violin was so lovely because you are obviously so skilled enough that you don't need to think technically on what you're doing when you play the violin. But so you only devote maybe like 10 or 15% of your brain capacity for like physically playing. And then the rest, it was a beautiful thing when you were playing the violin, and I forget her name when she was singing.
Sienna.
And she's I honestly thought that it was a Whitney Houston track playing. Yeah. And then I looked on stage and was like, oh, that's a person.
Yeah.
Oh,
she's so good.
Unbelievable. But the other like 85% of your attention was going to just being present and being there with her on stage. So she in turn could focus entirely on her voice and her music. And it was I was talking with people at my table and I was just like, can we not talk right now? I just want to watch this. Because it's a beautiful thing to watch people that are so talented and can not only are they talented, but are so present. And I think, yeah, it would be amazing if we could help develop a generation of people that can find their own ways to do that. Whether it's music or performing, that'd be really cool. But whether it's like writing or whatever it is, like gets them going.
Yep, I agree. Whatever gets them going, whatever drives them, I think people are motivated by different things, but if they have that energy there, I think that's something we should support.
And do you, I guess another thing is, do you play your music just for you, or do you want to leave a legacy behind of music and of medicine? Or is it really just like, I really like doing this stuff, and I like, even if no one else was around, I'd still play my violin.
Even if no one else was around, I'd definitely still play violin. I didn't like it when I was young, because my dad would spank me if I didn't play, if I didn't practice.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like, you know, no, why would I want to do this when there's punishment involved? But over the years, when I started to realize that I had developed a skill in this, that I was able to connect with other people who had also done the same thing, and then be able to just connect with people, as I mentioned before, who enjoy listening to the music or enjoy the performance in general.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I really started to want to play more on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And when I learned piano too at the age of 7, and that was something that my dad didn't force me to do starting out. So it's something that I like to do. And I remember one day, and I was practicing some more, and it was dinner time, and my dad told me it was to come to the dinner table, but I still kept on practicing, and then he yelled at me, and then I came. But it's like that kind of drive where you are just so interested in something, you continue to do it. Now that's kind of the drive with music, or with violin as well.
It sounds like you had... Yeah, what do you think about that relationship with the violin versus the piano? Like, it sounds like you had a little bit of a rocky, externally motivated relationship, but then with the piano, you found something that was much more intrinsic and much more, I don't want to say pure, but much more, like, expressive of who you are.
Yeah, I think it was more natural at the beginning for me, but... throughout the years, I think piano has gone in a different direction than violin. Piano for me now is more playing songs that I can sing to, so it's like adding that aspect, and it's more kind of fun and like laid back and relaxed. Violin, there's still classical pieces that are really difficult that I have to put in a lot of work for, and they're pretty different, actually. So I definitely can still play violin for fun, for that, like at the med student scholar dinner.
Mm-hmm.
But I think each has taught me different things. violin, more so on the perseverance side and attention to the details for every little musical nuance that is written down or that you want to add in. You have to remember that and like keep on repetition and memorizing. And then for piano, it's there's some of that too, but it's more like singing with friends or when I just want to relax and play like a Disney song that I grew up with or something.
Mm-hmm. And you had your Disney song collection was on point. On point. I was loving it. Have you, and so part of that musical legacy, have you thought about teaching others?
Yeah, I've had a few students in the past for music. Mm-hmm. I'm teaching one person violin right now here in Tampa. And I think if I have more time, I can teach more. I want to teach in a way that's not exactly how I learned on violin. Mm. I think my grandfather taught me piano, so his way was a lot more positive reinforcement oriented. And it's interesting because he wasn't like that with my dad and my dad's brothers. Mm-hmm. When he was teaching them violin, he was very like negative reinforcement.
Mm-hmm.
But I think positive reinforcement works really well. And the way I want to teach is to be able to teach the technique and then ask, you know, what songs do you like? And let's start learning some of those songs and see if, you know, you can pick up the instrument faster through something that you're familiar with already. And instead of like trying to learn an entirely new piece that you've never heard before that you may or may not like.
It's very interesting that the grandfather had a much is that different approach, because within certain shamanic traditions,
mm-hmm.
Like specific Amazonian ones, or even within certain Native American tribes, the shamans would entirely avoid, because they knew that it was too close, the father to son teaching.
Mm.
It was always grandfather to grandson, so it would skip a generation, so it would lose that like, this is my legacy. Like, this is, you know what I mean? That, like, really too closeness. And the grandfather he's already done all those things, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, this is all gravy on top. And so it's like, it loses that tension, and it can be much more of a supportive role and ultimately healthier for both individuals.
Mm, that's really interesting.
Mm.
I haven't delved into, like, reading about others' experiences and others' cultures, like, on teaching and generations. That's cool.
Yeah, it's a very interesting thing. And also, for me as a coach, so I grew up, I started athletics very late, in, like, high school and college, but I was a rower primarily. And a lot of my journey as a coach now, for CrossFit specifically, is I want to be a coach that I could have had growing up.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big part of my journey as a coach, is I felt like I never had a coach who taught me or led me in the way that I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of my development as a coach now is to try to be a coach that I would have wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And I fail and I stumble, but it's a very, I resonate very strongly with your feeling of like trying to teach in a different way than you were taught, because I've learned a lot of ways of coaching that don't really work.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to hone in on ways that do work.
Yeah. It's interesting to hear like different people having that kind of approach, where it's like you were taught this way and it wasn't effective, so I'm gonna try something new, versus other people who are like, oh, it's taught this way, so I'm just gonna teach this way. I don't know what it is. It's, you know, it's a different way of thinking.
Yeah, it's a very different approach, and I like to think of it as tending a garden. Very slow and steady, and not as fast as you would like sometimes, but you can't, a flower, you will not get a flower the day you plant something.
Mm-hmm.
And learning that has been a very slow and painful journey for me, but also it's something that I learned on the receiving end of trying to be the plant that is not going to flower for a couple of years, and it's very tough. So how do you want, so you want to do good, you want to leave behind a positive legacy, and you want a family. I think we talked a lot about you want to leave behind a legacy, but what kind of good do you want to leave behind, or what kind of good do you want to do?
I think if I can make something sustainable, like a sustainable project for health, I think to me health is still the most important thing I can do for people. And if it, I'm interested in global health, and my MPH right now is in global health. So if there's some partnership or something that I can create, or something that's already here that I can be a part of, that is able to give more resources or continue a beneficial relationship with a population that doesn't have as much, I think that's what I would consider doing good.
And so your vision of doing good is something that you will do, something that you haven't yet quite figured out. You haven't been placed in that specific opportunity where you as Samson Liu, the only Samson Liu in the world, can do something that is uniquely Samson Liu. Or is it possible that you could have done that? Like, is it something that must be like a project that you do, or could it be in the smaller things, in the way you interact with people?
Yeah, it's definitely along the way too. Like what you decide to spend your time doing, I guess says a lot. So if I think with my scholarship society, we go out and volunteer in the community. So we dedicate time to that and things like that. And also being like a mindful person when you interact with other people, and being sensitive when the time calls for it. I think it's all like on the path, just like do good when you see the opportunity, you know?
There's a quote, and I won't try to say it, but it was just like evil is when you see an opportunity for good, but you do not take it. And it's a little extreme, but I resonate very strongly with that. Just if you see the opportunity, if you see even if it's as stupid or as small as picking up a plastic bottle and throwing it in the recycling, when you see it just rolling around in the ground, you're like, no one's going to pick this up. No one is. Like, no one's going to do that. You might as well do it yourself. But the thing with those little acts is there's, it doesn't culminate in something that when you're on your deathbed, you can be like, this is it, you know? And yeah, it's a tough thing. That the whole legacy of leaving something behind and to do good is very intertwined. And I agree, it's very similar for me.
Do you think leaving legacy is something that you want others to remember you by? Because I when you asked, like, on your deathbed, like picking up a bottle versus is making a project that like is continued after you're gone. Like, those are like different levels of benefiting things. But that the latter one will be remembered by other people. And I don't know, do you think that remembrance is what drives you?
Well, A, I'm not the one getting interviewed here. But B, it's a very interesting thing. Like, there's a quote that I recently saw at MOSI, the museum, like the Science and Industries Museum here recently. It was that there you can do an awful lot of good in this world if you don't care who gets the credit. And I'm very much along that. I want to create a movement and some projects that will resonate and change the world beyond me, but I do not care if I can enjoy the fruits of my labor, and I don't care if I am remembered for my labor. I just want to create something that is beyond me, because that there's another quote that I love, that the true health of a society can be measured by whether or not old men plant trees that they know they'll never stand in the shade of, or something like that.
Yeah.
And that is what I want. I want to be an old man that plants trees, and I know I'll never stand in their shade. But I can still plant them with love, and I can still put all of my effort as if I know what my legacy will be remembered with, like, a little plaque at their base. But it's not that important to me. What about you?
Yeah, I agree. I think life will go on without me. And it doesn't really matter after I'm just gone, right? It's like, it's like when in medicine, when you have, like, the names of different diseases after people, and now they're trying to make it more scientific so that it's, like, a more generic name, so you don't have to remember, like, oh, this is...
like Graves' disease or something. Yeah.
And you actually have the description of the disease in the name, and that'll be better. It's, like, easier to remember. But,
at the same time, you lose that legacy of that person, or like somebody's sign, or, like, you know, like Hartnup's sign or whatever. Mm. It's like there's a person who figured it out, was the first person and brought it to others and was like, hey, everybody, isn't this really cool? And they're like, yeah, let's name it after you.
Yeah.
And there's something beautiful about, you know, I don't imagine that they named it after themselves, but you know, that there's a remembrance of a person by the collective, by the community of that person. And to lose that is a little, it can be sad.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, as a med student, I'm pretty okay with it.
Yeah, that's true.
And so you also want a family.
Yeah, I think it'd definitely be nice to have my own family.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking of adopting a few, like two, maybe. as well as having children of my own.
Mm.
But
is it... is it important for you or for the family that exists now that it is... Like do you care who your partner is if your Chinese bloodline continues? Or is that totally not even a concern for you?
No, that's not a concern. I think it'd be nice to keep language, teach the Chinese language, or whatever my wife's languages are. And if you grew up in that environment and you're multilingual, that would be pretty nice.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have a strong desire to marry someone Chinese necessarily. My parents have told me in the past that I should find someone Chinese, or now my grandma's telling me I should find someone white because they're pretty. So there's a lot of
mixed messages,
different views in my family.
Mm-hmm.
But really, I don't care as long as I can trust them and we have a really loving relationship. That's all that matters.
And for any adopted children, is it important for you what ethnicity? Is it important where they come from? Is it important for you what age they are?
Those are... I think the age thing I haven't thought through as much.
Mm-hmm.
I guess younger age would be better for me. Maybe just thinking out loud right now.
Mm-hmm.
As I'll be able to bring them up in a environment that they are used to throughout their life, I guess. But ethnicity really doesn't play a role, I guess. I did think in the past that it would be nice to be like multinational, multi-ethnic family coming together, growing up. But it's not of primary importance, I guess.
It's a very... There are two things that spring to mind. The first one is about the young adopted child.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, I, of course, I'm not really comparing like adopted children to rescuing a puppy. But it's very similar in that when you rescue a puppy...
Mm-hmm.
versus rescuing an older dog, when you rescue an older dog, you don't know what you're trying to untrain, or you don't know what things have been buried in there.
Mm-hmm.
Like if they bark at, you know, specific like types of people, it's like, what happened to you?
Yeah.
You know? And you know, you're trying to like figure out, and you can't go back in the past and understand, and you can't go back in the past and change it.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with like a teenaged adopted child. It's like there's so much pain and trauma with an adopted child, and it's like to try to, if you don't get them, if you, not that you get them when they're young, but you know, if they're older like that, you're trying to work around all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And with a younger child, it's almost like a more tabula rasa. You're more able to create, as you said, create a fostering and loving environment for them.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing was something that I kind of forgot while I was talking, but probably not that important, right? So, what else do you want before you die?
What else do I want? I think I'd like to record some music.
Mm.
And actually, like, have an album or something. That would be fun.
Mm. Have you recorded anything yet?
I've recorded with some of my friends. Nothing on my own yet, although I've been talking with one of my friends about doing so. Nothing has happened thus far.
Everything will happen in its own time, right?
Yeah.
But it's also a tough thing, especially if it's going to be like your first solo recording.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big weight around it. And
yeah.
Yeah,
my friend in Miami, he's worked on his first album for literally 3 years, and it's still not out yet.
And there's something about that where it's like if you put too much weight on it, it cripples you. It stops you from being able to do what you need to do, which is create your art and your music and your love.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of, I had the same exact problem with me in podcasting.
Mm-hmm.
I felt very deeply that I could create a beautiful podcast or something. And I was always struck. I was like trying to figure it out. And then the idea for this podcast came to me actually while I was floating. And I immediately was like, I need to get this idea out of my head. I can't wait for it. And let me just use my phone and just as ghetto as possible, just refine my skills. And, you know, there's something very beautiful about the internet where you don't need to wait anymore to produce your art.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you, like there are so many people out there that have become like relatively famous, millions of views that's just on YouTube,
mm-hmm.
and just throwing their music up there for consumption.
Yeah.
And rather than having the barrier of like, I need to create an album, you know, like your friend in Miami, it's like, if you create an album, you gotta produce it. You gotta like make sure you have all the tracks together. All
mm-hmm.
the ones are good, you know, but if you just do it one at a time, it's a very, it's democratized the production of art.
Yeah.
So profoundly. And like same with the blog, like all you need to do is write a blog once a week for a couple of years and boom, you have a large corpus of work.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think if I didn't get into medical school, I would have gone to California and made YouTube videos.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Mm.
I thought about that before.
Mm. I mean, and to be honest, like, if I had thrown, I would have, like, even if it was just, like, a phone video of you and Sienna,
mm-hmm.
just on the stage, like, that would have, I would have loved to watch that video. Just, you know, there's something about not even just you creating a video, but also performing in that
mm-hmm.
moment. It's a very interesting thing, just how you can just capture it now and,
mm-hmm.
and have it for posterity. Do you have friends in California that are doing stuff like that?
I have a few friends. I don't think they're doing video stuff. One's doing modeling on the side as she's a research scientist primarily.
Mm.
So that's pretty cool.
Pretty cool.
I have two friends who are singing, but not necessarily making YouTube videos. They're just
mm.
trying to become an artist, singer-songwriter type. They haven't put much effort into YouTube videos, I don't think. Well, I guess one of them has produced a music video that's now online, and it's on Vivo, and it was actually broadcast in a couple of gyms. I think it was LA Fitness, and my friend saw me in it because I was in that music video.
Oh.
So it was like broadcast across the nation or something. That was pretty funny.
Mm-hmm.
But who else? One person's doing just medicine out there. or I guess a couple of people. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not familiar with like big YouTube artists. Not like personal friends with them.
Yeah, and it's very, I mean, in the same way that, like, in, like, the whole, like, fluid moving relationship, like, what draws me to podcasting is that it's not what the medium is now, it's what it will be. And what will the medium of podcasting be in 10 years? And what will the medium of YouTube be in 10 years? You know, like, because it doesn't really matter now, because you're still young, you're still figuring it out, but that, like, longer term, like, developing relationship is a very interesting one. Anyway, should we start talking about when you die?
Sure.
Yeah? All right, when I die, I want.
When I die, I want to fall asleep. Go away peacefully. When I die, I want. When I die, I want. It would be nice to have family nearby and to be able to say some words of wisdom or something where, like, you know, more or less it's the last time that I'm gonna see you, so here's some things to keep in mind. What else?
It's a very, those last words, it's so funny because it's sort of very similar to when people give responses to these prompts. Like, I can tell when they've been, like, there's a rapidness in the response that I'm like, oh, you've prepared this. And some of yours have been, but it's not like a bad thing, but it's also very interesting to compare those prepared responses versus the ones that just come out. And in sort of the same way that, you know, if you die unexpectedly, and the last words were just something very cheerful, you know? There's something about those kinds of, like, unexpectedly happy last words or, like, something that will really resonate versus something that you've prepared so much that it's, like, taken that soul out of it. Have you received any of those last words from anyone?
Not really, but I do remember the last time I saw my grandfather, the one who taught me piano. What did he tell me? I don't know now. I think he just told me to take care of myself. And then I was leaving the hospital room and I saw him wave. And I had this weird feeling that, like, that might be the last time I see him. And it happened to be. He, like, went into the surgery. I'm not really sure what exactly happened, but he went into the OR or something, and then he didn't survive. So I've had, like, those last moments, but I haven't had, like, much of a, like, profound listen to me, this is what I want to pass on to you before my time is up.
And has that moment with your grandfather, him going into OR versus him passing on his own naturally, has that affected your view of wanting to go out sleeping, going out as you sleep?
Not so much. I think he was, I don't really know the moment when he passed away, what the circumstances were. But he seemed pretty at peace with everything the last time I saw. And I think that peacefulness is the most important. Like, if I die on the OR table, I'm knocked out, that's fine.
Fair enough. You're, like, out anyway, right?
Yeah.
And you want family with you. Is there anything else you want when you die?
Oysters. If you can give me, like, a raw oyster with some cocktail sauce, that'd be great.
Go out with a little something in the belly. Yeah,
maybe some music. I think music would be nice.
Would you want to go out playing music, or would you just want to go out hearing it?
What do you mean? Like, before I die,
I don't know, something.
Playing violin, not my deathbed.
or like humming or something.
Oh.
You know, okay. Or something related to, like, would you want somebody to be, like, or let me put it this way, who would, do you know who you'd want to be playing the music for? Who would be playing the music to you as you pass?
Probably just a recording, honestly. I think it'd be really tough to have somebody playing music live as I'm actively dying. I think just a song that has been meaningful. It would set the mood. I don't know. Yeah, I wouldn't ask anyone to play for me as I die. Maybe before I die. I think before I die would be nice. Like, I played for this one lady in the ICU once, and it was like 9 a.m. No, it was around noon when I went in, and her entire family was there, or most of them, and I played songs that she requested and some other songs that I just pulled out. But she was cognizant, she was clapping for me, she was thanking me. And then her son called me like 3 hours later and said she passed away. And so I think something like that would be ideal. It's like you get to spend the last moments enjoying something together, and then it's a good way to go.
Yeah, and there's something so communal about it that like brings you all together rather than just being sad.
Yeah. And I think I also would like people to celebrate my life more than like mourning, if possible. Just be like, pull out funny photos or something. Like, yeah, he was a weird guy.
Yeah, trying to balance mourning and like happiness that it even happened is tough. Especially when you're talking about other people's feelings. It's like, I can't tell you other people how to feel,
but
wish that you would, you know?
Yeah.
What about after you die? What do you want?
I think I'd like to have set some kind of example for others in my family after I die, for, I don't know, whether it be like respect or like being open to new things, or seeing the importance in diversity, just being able to take care of others and take care of each other. I think that's most important. If I can reach others outside of my family, that'd be nice, but I'm not. Sometimes that can be really hard, but it's just like, as long as I left some meaningful lessons for people in my family, I think that would be all I ask for.
Just that ripple to keep going a little bit.
Yeah.
Be nice.
Yeah.
Is that all you want, or is there something else you want after you die?
What else do I want? I mean, if I do leave a legacy that continues, it's ideally sustainable. I don't know. I'll be gone. It'll be up to the rest of the people in the world to continue life.
Is there a direction you want people to go when they continue life? You mentioned you want more respect of diversity, but is there any other direction that you want? They want these crazy people to go once you're gone.
Any other direction? Harmony, collaboration. Those are like general terms to throw out. I guess if society wise, if people can continue to focus on like needs in society, and like being sure that marginalized populations don't get just like thrown out to the side, like that their views are not considered, and just being able to realize how much you already have and how much you can offer to others who might not have as much, and like being appreciative of that. And I feel like if you just took a little more time to reflect on that, if like people in general took more time to reflect on that, that would help the world in a little way that, I don't know, that
just slow down, think about stuff.
Yeah.
Be quiet for a little bit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. So there are people listening through the phone in the future, and they've probably listened to the whole thing if they've gotten this far. Do you have any parting words to them? Any little words of wisdom? Anything that you would have wanted to hear when you were a younger, shorter-haired Samson?
Shorter-haired. I would say when it comes to it, like, be yourself as much as you can, and do things that excite you, and it will be hard along the way if you have this passion that maybe financially is not very rewarding, but if that's what you love to do, go for it, go do it. It's a part of you and it's not going to leave you. So if you give it your all, money will find a way. It's not that money doesn't matter and you shouldn't just like disregard money, but you'll be able to pull those long nights where you like, you work when you have to, and then you do what you love when you can, and like persevering through that, will get you where you want to go.
Those are good last words. Thank you much, very much, Samson.
Thanks.
This has been a pleasure.
Yeah.
It's been Samson Liu on Death.